apologist is really somebody who makes a defense for something. It doesn't have to be the Bible. It could be anything. You have apologists for different professions that are maybe under attack, like the legal profession. You have, now they're the brunt of all jokes, so now they have to have apologists for the legal profession or whatever. And a Christian apologist is somebody who makes a defense for his understanding of the truth in the Bible, Christianity. And the reason I want to make that particular point clear, well, the two reasons, is first of all, I think people do not normally associate Christianity and careful thinking in the same sentence. In fact, when I use the term clear thinking Christianity, people accuse me of using an oxymoron, a contradiction of terms, like a jumbo shrimp or a straight talking politician or military intelligence or something like that. You know, these are words that don't go well together. And so Christianity is viewed as by many as I viewed it when I was in college, before I was a Christian myself, as a place where people who can't think for themselves go to let somebody else do the thinking for them. And so when one thinks of the concept of an individual who is committed to making an intelligent, rational, carefully thought out defense for Christianity, it seems like an odd thing to some people. But that's what I do. And I do that because I think that religious points of view can be defended, certain ones of them. And that religion isn't the kind of thing that you just have to, you know, punt to guesswork, and everybody's got their different idea, and nobody's idea is any better than anybody else's. I think that there are some better ideas, and there's ways of defending it. And so I've spent the major portion of the last 20 years doing that. And so in that arena, making a defense, I have to employ the kind of things that you use, that you're learning here in this class. I saw a list of fallacies that you're learning about. That's not just like an academic exercise. If you understand what those fallacies are, you can pull out your LA Times and you can find examples of them up and down the editorial page, letters to the editor, all kinds, and many more that aren't on the list. And as a radio talk show host myself now for going into my ninth year, I have to field lots of points of view, and my goal is to deal with those points of view carefully, respectfully, but incisively. In other words, using our best thinking to try to get down to the truth of it. And in the process, I've encountered a lot of what I think very fundamental errors that people make when they deal with religious issues. And what I'd like to do in the first part here is just to give you a dozen of those, a dozen ways that people argue about religion or religious ideas that are just bad. They are bad conclusions or assertions or bad ways of thinking they apply to the issue. Now, I am not here arguing in favor of any particular religion at this particular point. So I'm not here as an advocate for Christianity. I'm here as a person who understands something about the process of thinking carefully about these issues and wants to offer you some observations about how people have gone awry in upending religion or the God question or moral issues in the past. It may be, another way of putting it is, it may be that there are lots of good arguments against religion, against moral viewpoints, against the existence of God. There may be a lot of those out there, but the ones that I'm going to share with you do not qualify as good arguments against it. All right? And some of it may surprise you, because I suspect that some of the things I'm going to say have occurred to you as rather cogent ways of addressing the issue, yet they're beset with certain fallacies or problems or difficulties when you look at them a little bit more closely. And of course, if you disagree with my assessment on that, we can talk about it during the break. So what I'd like to do, though, is ask you to withhold your comments, rejoinders, questions, whatever, until I do my basic presentation. Once I've done that, then we can mix it up and talk around about some of the issues. Fair enough? Okay, I'm going to write them on the board for you to make it a little easier to follow. But here's the first one that I encounter. Actually, these aren't in any particular order. They're all significant, but they're all things I encounter on a regular basis. And whenever I want to even talk about the question of truth, religious truth, make a particular claim about religion, I often get this particular mistake. The first mistake is assuming there is no truth. The first mistake is assuming there is no truth. And so if somebody claims that his point of view is true, it's easy to brush it off by simply saying there is no truth. Now, the problem with that, and I'm always mystified by this, I suspect there aren't so many in this class that would hold to this view, or else you wouldn't be in a class like this, a class that has to do with public discussion, debate, communication of some sort, that teaches you how to adjudicate issues of truth. If there are no truths to adjudicate, there's no reason having any arguments or any debates about issues of truth. But I will tell you, it is one of the most popular points of view in the campus nowadays, and it's almost thoroughly unexamined by most people who say this. What mystifies me about people who make the statement that there is no truth is that the people who make that statement actually believe that the statement itself is, guess what? True. They believe this is a true statement, which, if you're quick on your feet, you see they've already got a big problem. Because if the statement is true, it's false. If it's true that there is no truth, then there at least is one truth, that there is no truth, and therefore there is a truth, and therefore the statement is false. This is one of those statements that can't possibly be true, in fact. There's no way it could be true. But it is an intellectual elitist point of view right now. It has taken over the academy under the guise of a concept known as postmodernism. It has captivated the imagination of a lot of people. It's popular to say this now. All right? Now, I suspect that one of your fallacies on your list is argumentum ad populum, which is to go with a point of view simply because a lot of people believe it. Well, that's a fallacy, because a lot of people could be mistaken. And they certainly seem to be on this particular issue. Now, I think that there is confusion here. People fall into this because they are not careful about the definition of this particular word. In fact, people get away with sloppy thinking on a lot of issues because they're not careful about definitions. The real key is, what does this word mean? And there's been a standard definition for this word from the time of Aristotle, and it really isn't so much that Aristotle defined it, because then you could say, well, maybe somebody else can define it differently. What Aristotle really did is he just identified the way people use the word, what they usually mean when they use the word truth. So when I say that it is true that there's a class in this room right now, the word truth means, the implications of it is that there actually is a class in this room right now. And if there were no class in this room and I said that there was, then my statement would not be true. It would be what? False. So our definition of truth is just the ordinary, everyday understanding of what it means for a thing to be true. If you say that it is, and it is, then that's true. If you say that it isn't, and it isn't, then that's true. But if you say that it is, and it isn't, or if you say that it isn't, and it is, that's false. Now, those were Aristotle's words, but they're very simple, very straightforward, the garden variety definition of truth. Or to put it in other terms, that which is truth is that true is that which corresponds to reality. That which fits the way things actually are. If I said that it's true that you're wearing a green shirt, and you are wearing a green shirt, which you are, then my statement is true. Very simple. It's the way we mean the word almost every single time that we use it. Unless we're talking about things that really matter, and all of a sudden we become skeptics and agnostics with regards to the issue of truth. If we hold that there is no truth, what we are holding is that there are no statements that correspond to the way things really are. Which is rather absurd, because it seems to me that there are all kinds of things that we hold to be the case, and that we can test out and determine that they in fact are the way things really are. The number of people in this room, for example. So, the first mistake is assuming that there is no truth. Then what's really bizarre is people try to argue that there is no truth, I mean, which is compounds the problem. That's the first mistake. Here's a second mistake. And this is somewhat related. It is, this is kind of a favorite of mine, misusing the blind man and the elephant illustration. You know the blind man and the elephant story? Probably heard this. That's an Indian parable about nine blind men who went into a city for the first time. And when they were in the city, they encountered an elephant. in the plaza there, right outside the Raja's castle. And so they started the process of discovery. What is this? And one blind man grabbed the elephant by the tail. And he said, oh, an elephant? An elephant's kind of like a rope. Remember, you can't see, you can only feel it. An elephant's like a rope. And another man feels the side of the elephant. And he says, well, the elephant, no, it's not like a rope. It's like a wall. That's what an elephant is. Another, touching the leg of the elephant, says, no, an elephant is more like a pillar. And on around the elephant, the ear like a big leaf, the tusk like a spear. And so a big argument ensues. Are you familiar with this? You've probably heard this because it has a particular application. Actually, it has two applications in common discussions. The argument ensues about who's right. And finally, there's so much commotion in the plaza there that it wakes up the Raja, and he comes out onto the balcony. And he says, shut up. I'm trying to sleep. The elephant is a big animal. You each have a little piece of the elephant. Put them all together, you got the whole thing. Okay, that's the parable. Now, here's the application. One application is a religious application. And people say, this is like religion. Every religion has a little piece of the truth. No religion is really wrong. All the religions, when combined, is the biggest explanation of what the real truth is. All right? Now you also have a postmodernist approach using the same parable. And that approach is that every person is locked into his own perceptions, his own cultural scheme of things, his own language tradition that makes it incapable of understanding the other person's situation. And so we are all locked into our own little world of perception and can't get out of it. And therefore, we're not justified in saying that our way is the correct way and somebody else's way is the wrong way. Okay? You with me so far on that application? Now, here's the problem. That's the way the story goes, and that's the way the application is. And this is where some that hold this view, that there is no truth, offer this as an explanation. Now, here's the problem. I always ask the person the question who is giving me the story. I say, where are you in the story? Are you one of the blind men? Because the story holds that we're all blind men, right? For an explanation. Are you one of the blind men? Because if you're one of the blind men, then how is it that this explanation of the world is the correct one? Because you're blind like everybody else, and you just have a little piece of the truth. So your explanation can't be the whole truth. And if he says, no, I'm not one of the blind men, I'm the Raja, then my question is going to be, how is it that you have a complete picture of the world and you see everything accurately and everybody else is blind? And that's the perspective that most people have, frankly, when they tell the story. Because they are offering this story as an accurate picture of the world. But the moral of the story is that no one has such an accurate picture of the world. Except for the Raja, but you see, the participants in life really are the blind people, according to the story. Now, and so people use this all the time to try to prove something with this illustration. They end up, if you look at it carefully, disproving their own position in the process. Now, there's one little postscript here I'll add before I move on to the next point. And the postscript is that this particular story actually does apply to certain religious claims. And those claims are those claims in which human beings have a limited amount of knowledge and God has a full picture. And the only way we could know the full picture is if God himself tells us. And so when in the monotheistic traditions of the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, you do have a God who is a personal being in a position of privileged access to the whole story who can then communicate it to the blind people in a way that the blind people can understand. At least that's their claim. So there's a sense in which the three monotheistic religions of the world could make use of this parable, but when they do so, they're really using it to show exactly the opposite of what those people who use the parable for religious purposes intend to show, that no one can know. And in fact, what the parable shows is at least one person can know, the person that sees all. And at least in principle, that person could be God, would be God, and in principle, he's capable of communicating what he sees to the rest, just as the Raja communicated it to the other blind men, or to the blind men. That's the second one. Let's look at the third one. The third a bad way to argue about religion is confusing objective claims with subjective claims. Confusing objective claims with subjective claims. And I'll tell you how this sounds. I've encountered this many, many times. I say, Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world. That's true. The truth is that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world. He is the Messiah. You say, but that's your truth. I say, this is the truth, and you say, that's your truth. I'm speaking rhetorically now about you. I don't know what your views are. People will respond to me all the time, and this happened all the time on Religion on the Line. It was unbelievable how often this happened with religious people. I was there with a Roman Catholic priest, a rabbi, and another talk show host for a while, Dennis Prager. And then as Dennis moved to another time slot, they had another host in there. And when I would make my, I would, in a sense, throw my gauntlet down into the arena. I'd say, here's my point of view. I think this is true. There it is. Let's talk about that. Instead of talking about the claim, the people in the panel would try to relativize my claim. No, it's not true. It's your truth. Now, the phrase your truth is just another way of saying that you believe it. This is just what you believe. Well, of course I believe it, or I wouldn't be saying it. So saying it's your truth doesn't add anything to the conversation. What it does is it creates confusion. Because what I am attempting to do is at least make an objective claim about the nature of the world. Now, I'm not saying at this point the claim is true. I'm talking about the nature of the claim, not whether the claim is true. Okay? I might say that there's a pink elephant in this room. I'm making a claim that's either true or false. Then we could all talk about whether this elephant is sitting on this table here or not, you know. And it could turn out that my claim is false, but it's a claim that is meant to be about the nature of the objective world, what's true out there. I'm not talking about what I prefer. I'm not saying I happen to like the idea of elephants sitting on this desk. It appeals to my tastes like it was an ice cream flavor or something. But that's what people are trying to make my claim out to be when I make such a claim. Now, the problem with saying this is, first of all, it misrepresents what the claimant is trying to do. You say, well, this is the truth. And I say, no, that's just your belief. Well, that's not what the claim is. So it's disrespectful to the person making the claim. Take the claim at face value and defeat the claim, but don't try to tell this other person that they're not really saying what they're really saying. The second thing is it ends discussion. It just simply ends discussion because there's nothing to talk about. If it's just simply your belief, then there's no reason to, like your preference, what you like in your taste, like you like ice cream or something like that. You like butter pecan ice cream as opposed to chocolate or something like that. Well, what's to talk about? But when one makes a claim about the nature of the world, that's at least third person accessible, then third person parties can discuss whether the claim's either true or false. So the problem with confusing an objective claim with a subjective claim is first of all, it doesn't treat with respect the claim itself and treat it as the kind of claim it is so that you can find out whether it's true or false. And secondly, it simply ends discussion so you can't pursue the issue, which I think is rather interesting because it strikes me sometimes as a cowardly way to deal with a claim. Instead of addressing the claim and taking it at face value and seeing whether it's true or not, people use this technique to just say, go away, shut up, which strikes me as a rather impolite way to deal with somebody's point of view. Okay, that's the third mistake. Fourth mistake. Using arguments that aren't arguments. Using arguments that aren't arguments. I'm going to give you two kinds. An argument is a very particular kind of thing. It isn't somebody giving his point of view with a loud voice and in your face. Now, by the way, I make a distinction here between an argument and a fight, because that is a good description of the start of a fight. An argument is a very particular kind of thing. It is not just an assertion. Assertion is a point of view, an opinion. Okay. What's the difference between an assertion and an argument? an assertion, or rather an argument, is a point of view with reasons that buttress the conclusion. In an argument, they treat the point of view as a conclusion. It doesn't just hang out there. I'll oftentimes have people that'll make a statement to me about the nature of the world and religion, contrary to something that I believe or I've been talking about. And it's almost as if they're putting their hands on their hips and saying, okay, refute that. And my response is, what's to refute? There's no argument. It's just a point of view. And so what I'm going to want to see from that person, now that I understand his opinion or her point of view, I want to know why they believe that that point of view is actually true. Why it's a good point of view. Why it should be believed over some other point of view, like maybe mine. I want reasons. This is also called justification or warrant or grounding, the idea that your point of view is on stable ground instead of just floating around in midair. I'll have people that'll call me on the radio show and they'll say, such and so made this point. How do I refute it? I said, there's nothing to refute. It's simply an opinion. You need to ask that person, why should I believe that? Now, this kind of thing happens all the time in universities, and professors are the biggest offenders. One young man I was having breakfast with told me he was going to school here somewhere in Southern California, and he said, my professor said in class that the Bible is just a bunch of fables. Now, how do I refute that? And I said, you don't have any obligation to refute it at this point. Since he made the claim, it is his job to substantiate his point of view first. So instead of trying to refute him, and you're at a disadvantage already because he's the man with the microphone, as it were, he's in front of the class, and that already gives him a position of power, instead you make him give evidence for or justify his own point. Excuse me, Professor, I'm just curious. You say the Bible is only fables. Do you have any evidence to back that up, or is that just a point of view, or are you just taking that on faith? Well, that's a fair question to ask. And this student, when he asked the professor just said, I have these books. Now, what he did was what I call a phantom argument. I have these books. Now, how do you deal with that? He makes a statement, the student asks for evidence, and he just says, I have these books. Well, you can't really deal with these books because they're out there somewhere. You don't know what they say. It's just a power play by the professor. He said, now what do I do? I said, you do this. You say, and I have these books. You invoke your phantom sources against his phantom sources. Obviously, that doesn't get you anyway, but it takes the power away from him, and it points out that he's just stalling. Now, maybe he doesn't have time to substantiate his claim, but then one wonders, what's the point of making the claim? Why does he come into class and say the Bible's just a fable, and then is not even willing to lift a finger to make sense out of the claim? If he makes the claim, it seems to me he has a rational obligation to support it, and not just simply use his position of power as the teacher to browbeat people who might have more of a reverence for the Bible. I mean, a fable is a particular kind of thing. People write fables. They have a particular literary form to them. C.S. Lewis, some of you might have read, the famous scholar from Oxford who was a medieval literature scholar and also a very intelligent defender of Christianity, he said, I write fables. That's my business. I know what fables look like. I know how they start, how they end. I know all the fables that were ever written. The Bible is not a fable in that same sense. Now, it may be that the Bible isn't true, but see, you're going to have to demonstrate that by doing something other than just calling it a name like a fable. And so understanding this point will allow you, first of all, to not be cowed by people who just make statements. And by the way, Christians do this all the time. Christians just simply say, the Bible's the Word of God, that's it. And they expect you to take it just on their word or something like that. And I think that's unfortunate, and I think that's asking too much of most people. I think there are ways to argue for it, but I think it's fair to say to the Christian, okay, that's your point of view, give me some reasons why I ought to believe that that point of view is really true. And by the same token, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If the professor is going to get up there and make these kinds of statements, well, it's appropriate for the professor then to offer his support as well. And if he isn't willing to offer that support for these kinds of claims that he makes, then I think it's entirely fair for students to challenge him on it. Well, I just want to know if you had any reasons, or if you're just taking it on faith, which is what they always say the Christians and other religious people do. But professors do this all the time. And so there's a problem of burden of proof that's associated with this. I'm going to come back to this in just a moment with another issue, and I'm going to illustrate that by coming back to this burden of proof issue in the professor's professorial power play. But one argument that isn't an argument is just simply an assertion. All assertions, if they're to be taken seriously, need to have some evidential support. And what will happen a lot of times is the professor will turn the table. They'll say, you think the Bible's not a fable then, I guess. Prove to me it's not a fable. Now, do you see the little sleight of hand that went on there? The professor makes the claim, you ask the professor to please substantiate the claim, and he forces you to prove him wrong. Well, that's a task that you can't accomplish. Don't take the bait. I mean, whatever the professor happens to be saying, it might not be about this particular issue, but when the professor makes, don't take the bait, and here's how you respond. You say, well, wait a minute, professor, I don't have a point of view here in our discussion. I'm not trying to make a case for anything. I'm not trying to prove anything about the Bible. You don't even know what my views happen to be. But you stood up there and you made a claim that sounded like a statement of fact. And I'm just simply asking if you got the goods. Now, to put it over on my shoulders tells me that apparently you don't have an answer. I'm not obliged to answer your question because I haven't made a claim. You're the one who made the claim. And it's kind of a nice way of saying put up or shut up. You know, you don't want to say that, especially if he's got the grade book. But, and some of you might think that that's a little a bold way to address a professor. I don't know what your attitude is here at school or whatever, but I think that's entirely fair. A lot of times students yell at professors and it's not justified. This is justified. And when professors pull that power play on you and they switch it around, it's entirely fair to say, wait a minute, you broke the rules here. I'm not making any claim. You made the claim. It's your job. You have the burden of proof. It's your job to give the reasons behind and substantiating your point of view. One other aspect here about using arguments that aren't arguments is when people use illustrations. An illustration isn't an argument. An illustration is just a way of elucidating or making more clear an opinion. That's it. They say, well, my point of view is like this. And in giving the illustration, they think that the illustration is evidential, that the illustration itself ought to be compelling. You know, we talk about religious pluralism. People say, wait a minute, all roads lead to Rome. Or all roads lead to the top of the mountain. And they act as if by just citing an illustration, they've given evidence for their point of view. It's not evidence, it's just an illustration. It's just a well-stated opinion. Why should I believe that all religions lead to the same place? I mean, the fact is, it's not even a very good illustration because all roads don't lead to Rome. Carson Street doesn't lead to Rome. Bad illustration. So you don't want to mistake an argument, an assertion, or a illustration for an argument. Arguments require reasons, not just illustrations or strongly stated opinions. 5, this is very common. It's got a technical name, but I'll give you the description right now. The fifth mistake is confusing motivation with justification. Confusing motivation with justification. This is commonly called the genetic fallacy, by the way. Is that on your list? Huh? It's not on your list? Okay. Well, you'll be familiar with this one. This is a favorite of Freud and Feuerbach. And you'll add it to the quiz. Thank you very much, Mr. Kokel. You made a job harder for everybody. Genetic fallacy. This is faulting a point of view because of its origins. All right? Consider the source, people might say. Well, just because it comes from a particular origin doesn't mean that it's necessarily false. Now, here's the way it usually presents itself in religious discussions. And this is the way Freud and Feuerbach and Nietzsche used it. You just are a Christian because you believe in God because you need to have a father figure. You need to feel comforted that there's something beyond the grave. You need something like that in your life. Another variation of this, by the way, is you're a Muslim because you were born in a Muslim society. Or you're a Christian because you were born in a Christian society. And therefore, the claims that Christians or Muslims are making about their faith are dismissed because the motivation somebody might have, whoops, I forgot that word, confusing, motivation is focused on rather than the justification. And here's what I mean by that. I'm a Christian. It just may be the case that the reason that I'm a Christian is because I need a father figure. I'm psychologically weak and I need to have something to depend on. But what does my psychological motivation to believe in Christianity have to do with the question of whether Christianity is true or not? Just because I may be motivated for some emotional reasons to believe something doesn't make that belief itself false, which is the way people try to treat this. Oh, you just believe that because of such and so. Well, maybe I'm a Christian because I live in a Western society. Maybe you're a Muslim because you were raised in Saudi Arabia. But the fact that you're a Muslim because you were raised in Saudi Arabia doesn't make Islam false. Whether Islam is true or false or Christianity is true or false has to be decided on something other than people's motivations for believing something. And actually, this knife cuts both ways, because a theist could easily say, oh, you atheists, you just don't want to believe in God because you don't want to face the prospect of judgment or something like that. Well, if it doesn't work for the atheist, it's not going to work for the theist. It's just as bad either way. And because an atheist might have a psychological motivation for not believing in God, it doesn't make God automatically exist. It has nothing to do with the issue. This is an irrelevant point, a person's motivation. You might have in there the circumstantial ad hominem. It's similar to this. It has nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with the question of whether the beliefs are true or not. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He says, first you've got to show that a person is mistaken before it's meaningful to ask why is he mistaken. Now, if I can find somebody that believes something that is patently false, and I can demonstrate it's false, it's meaningful to say, gee, why would anybody believe a thing like that? But I've got to show it's false first. I can't just look at the belief and then focus in on the motivation and then dismiss the belief. Because what motivates a person to believe something is different from what justifies those beliefs. So that's another mistake you don't want to make. Six. Yeah, look like I'm running out of time already. Confusing tolerance and intolerance. Confusing tolerance and intolerance. This word, tolerance and intolerance, these two words, have undergone a dramatic transformation over the last 10 or 12 years. In fact, the transformation is so dramatic, they now mean the opposite of what they used to mean. If you look in the dictionary, Webster's, to any dictionary, you'll see that tolerance means permitting, well, I'll read the definition here. The word tolerate means to allow or to permit, to recognize and respect others' beliefs and practices without sharing them, to bear or put up with someone or something not necessarily liked. So tolerance involves three things. It involves permitting, allowing, a conduct or point of view you disagree with, in other words, you think is wrong, while respecting the other person in the process. The classical view of tolerance in this country is that everybody gets a point of view. They have the right to think that their point of view is correct. They can argue for it in the public square. But in the midst of this discussion, we respect the differences, and we're willing to live with and tolerate those people that we disagree with. Now, six months ago, there was a meeting on Capitol Hill. It was a breakfast. And characteristically, these breakfasts, somebody has a prayer. It's basically just for show. But somebody, and different people say the prayer. Well, there was an occasion where a Christian man said the prayer over the breakfast. And when he finished his prayer, he ended it this way: in Jesus' name, amen. And I want to tell you, pandemonium broke out. People were mad at him. They got up out of their seat. They were raising their fists, yelling at him. It was a nightmare. Why? Because he was being, what's the word? What do you think they said? Intolerant. He was being intolerant. Now, why was he being intolerant? He was being intolerant because he mentioned Jesus Christ when there were a lot of people in the room that did not respect or revere Jesus Christ. There were Jewish people in the room. Now, here's what's curious about that, is that here is a man that had an opportunity to pray and was actually asked to pray, and he is a Christian. Yet what was demanded of him for tolerance is that he pray in a way that everyone could agree with. And he never said anything anyone disagreed with. Guess what? If you agree with it, you can't tolerate it. You can only be tolerant of things you disagree with. I ask people, do you tolerate homosexuality? They say, of course I do. I say, oh, you think that homosexuality is wrong? No, I don't. I think it's fine. Then you don't tolerate it. You agree with it. Tolerance is when you say, you're wrong, but I will exercise a measure of respect towards you in your ability to express that. In that sense, the appropriate response for the people listening to the prayer should have been, when the Christian gets up, he prays his Christian prayer. And when it's the Buddhist's turn to get up and pray, then he prays his Buddhist prayer. When the Jewish man gets up, he prays his Jewish prayer. And all of those people who do not agree with it sit there like adults and what? Tolerate the difference. You see, they had toleration all flipped around. And this is the way it is in society now. Now, if you say, my point of view is correct, I think I'm right about this, people call you intolerant. But you see, you have to think that your view is correct over someone else's before you can even tolerate them. That's the definition of the word. Tolerance has become intolerance in our culture. This is interesting. A friend of mine who I just finished a book with last year, it's going to be published, it's on the issue of moral relativism, Dr. Frank Beckwith, he said, you know, it's interesting in a culture where there's so much so-called diversity that everybody thinks the same. That everyone thinks the same. I remember back when the president was assembling his cabinet for the first time. He said, I want a cabinet that looks like America. Remember he said that? What's interesting is he was no concern for diversity of thinking. Only diversity of skin color, basically, and views towards sexuality, which strike me as the most insignificant of differences. What really matters in differences is what people think, not what color their skin is. Yet in our culture, what matters more and more, in this so-called tolerant culture, where skin color is what matters, but tolerating different points of view, forget it. I mean, in this an office where they want to have diversity, where is the Hasidic Jew? Where's the Mormon? Where's the born-again, right-wing, fundamentalist Christian? Where is the anarchist? Where is genuine diversity? It was a good observation. In this place of diversity, everybody thinks alike. Politically correct. 7, and I might cut my points here short just because for the sake of time, and I know you guys want to have at me here, or at least I'll go in more summary fashion. The 7th problem is assuming that different moral viewpoints proves moral relativism. When you take an anthropology course, one thing you learn right at the beginning is that different cultures seem to have different moral points of view. All right? And so you have our culture who treats widows in one way, but in India, before the British were there, they practiced sati, where the woman would throw herself or be thrown on the funeral pyre of her husband and be immolated and burned up. Okay? So that was their value. We have our values. There are different points of view. They go from... The mistake is... I think even, I'm not even sure that the observation is actually accurate, but I'll concede it for the sake of discussion here. The mistake is making the jump from the observation that different cultures have different points of view to the conclusion that therefore morality is relative and it's not absolute or objective in any sense. Coco, how can you say, people tell me, how can you say that there are objective moral rules, moral absolutes? The fact is, every culture has a different point of view. Well, you can't get from an observation that there are different points of view about morality to the conclusion that nobody's right. That's called a non sequitur. It doesn't follow. It's like there was a time when some people thought the world was flat and some people thought it was round. So there's a difference of opinion. Does that mean then, during the time that there was debate about the shape of the earth, that all of a sudden the earth became shapeless because people disagreed? No. And so you can't simply conclude, because there are different points of view, that nobody's right. It's a major error in thinking that people make in the area of morality. Number eight, and I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to erase these and start at the top here again. Number eight of our dozen. Confusing two definitions of science. This is a real big one, and I just kind of was let onto this problem recently where somebody pointed this out to me. I said, oh my gosh, that's brilliant. It's a brilliant observation about the discussion about evolution and creation in the public square right now. And in fact, I got a great example from the LA Times two or three days ago that I'm gonna read to you. There are two definitions of science that are employed in conversations about the issue of origins. I think that people have the impression that the so-called debate about evolution and creation is a debate about the facts of science and the faith of religionists. So it's fact versus faith, and that's the way it's portrayed in the papers. In fact, this article from Wednesday, April 15th, yesterday's LA Times, talks about that. It's a whole article about Evolution 101, the state's new standards for survival in science class, what can be taught, what can't be, and a rationale. Question and answer, kind of dialectic in the article there. But the problem is that I don't think that's a fair assessment, the facts of science versus the faith of religionists. But that is able to survive because there's confusion about two definitions of science. Here's the first definition. Science as a methodology. Scientific method, experimentation, observation, drawing accurate conclusions from the evidence in front of you. Okay, that's one definition. I think it's a wonderful definition. There's another definition, though. It's not science as methodology, it's science as philosophy. And there is a philosophy that drives science. It's the philosophy of naturalism. And naturalism is the point of view that all things are explained in terms of natural law, cause and effect, in a closed system. If the idea of closed system, there's nobody out there that's in here monkeying around. So science has to explain everything. When you're doing good science, in terms of the first definition, the methodology, and you come to the conclusion, as quite a few people have, that natural explanations are not the best explanations for the evidence in front of us. But rather, there are many details about the natural world that scream design, and in fact have that as the best explanation. What do you do then when the methodology is in conflict with the philosophy which demands that you only use natural law? I'll tell you what happens. The philosophy always trumps the methodology every single time. Down in San Diego, at San Diego State University, tonight, there's a chemist with impeccable credentials. His name is Michael Behe, who is lecturing. He wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. Some of you might be familiar with it. What he argues is that he is really making public what biologists have known for a long time, that biological systems are incredibly and irreducibly complex. Darwinian gradualism requires that you have little bitty incremental changes added one to another over time, and every level of those small changes is chosen in favor of and passed into the next generation by natural selection. Behe says living systems can't be explained that way because in many cases you have particular things that have to all be assembled intact before they work at all and can't be working just a little bit by little bit additions. He uses a mousetrap as an example. He says a mousetrap has got to work all together before it can catch any mice. You can't just have a piece of wood that catches some mice and then you put a spring on it and you catch a few more and then you put a spring with a hammer on it, and you catch a whole bunch more, and then when you add the food, you've got the best mousetrap. And you can see how that parallels Darwinian gradualism. He said living systems aren't that way. Now, what's interesting is Behe's methodology is impeccable. He hasn't made any errors in his scientific methodology. But his work is castigated because it's religion being passed off as science. Now, what was Behe's problem? Not his methodology. He had violated the other definition of science. So this isn't always about facts, ladies and gentlemen, in this debate. It's about a philosophy as well. And when the facts give you conclusions that don't fit the philosophy, the facts don't matter. And Richard Lewontin from Harvard University, one of the in the rarefied high stratums of evolutionary thinking in this country, in the New York Times Review of Books a year ago, January, said it very clearly. I mean, I got the quote. It's just incredible. If you want to know what the cognoscenti of this country are thinking about, they talk to each other in the pages of the New York Times Review of Books. It's a great place to go. And he said, look it, we believe this methodology not because something about the world demands the conclusions that we come to scientifically, but because we have a prior commitment to naturalism. And that commitment is unyielding, even though it produces conclusions that are highly counterintuitive. It's almost like he's saying the facts be damned. And here's how he ends. He says, because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, if you are aware that there are two definitions of science, you'll see in conversations when they're being conflated. Here it says in the LA Times article, aren't scientific beliefs based on faith as well, is the question that's asked. And they respond by this. Usually faith refers to beliefs that are accepted without empirical evidence. Most religions have tenets of faith. Science differs from religion because it is the nature of science to test and retest explanations against the natural world. Thus, scientific explanations are likely to be built on and modified with new information and new ways of looking at old information. This is quite different from religious beliefs. Therefore, belief is not really an appropriate term to use in science because testing is such an important part of this way of knowing. Of course, I don't know if you notice that the only kind of testing that they accept is empirical testing, which has some problems with that, but there's your methodological definition. And I think that's great. If you want to know about the natural world, you have tests and you try to disprove and you use the methodology. But what happens when the methodology indicates that there is a designer that's at work? And incidentally, so you don't think that this is just some biased point of view that I have, Richard Dawkins, who has written, who's probably, other than Stephen Jay Gould, is the best known in the world popular writer in evolution. He wrote The Blind Watchmaker, The Selfish Gene, The Climbing Mount Improbable. He says in The Blind Watchmaker that the biological world is a place in which it looks like it has been designed for a purpose. But it hasn't, he says. It's really the blind watchmaker of natural selection that's accomplished it. But he makes this admission. The world looks like it's been designed. And so what happens when your evidence happens to show that? Well, then you're trumped. And here's where it comes up just a couple paragraphs later. Talking about science, it says, scholarship is evaluated by professionals and educators in those fields. In science, scientists as well as educators have concluded that evolution, and only evolution, should be taught in science classes. And watch this. Here's the sleight of hand. Because it's the only scientific explanation. Well, wait a minute. If scientific explanation is any explanation that's justified by the methodology, well, then creation could be justified by the methodology. The idea that design is there, even Richard Dawkins admits that the evidence seems to show that. No, there's a different definition here. When they say it is only the only scientific explanation, they mean it is the only explanation that doesn't include God. That's the philosophy. Trumping the evidence, trumping the other definition of science. Confusing two definitions of science. 8, 9. This very quick. Replacing the God of the gaps with the science of the gaps. Christians were faulted in the past by appealing to anything that they couldn't explain. Appealing to God for anything they couldn't explain. Called it the God of the gaps. Thunder. What's that? We don't know what that is. It must be God bowling or something. God's voice. God's groaning or something like that. God of the gaps. Of course, now we know what thunder is. There's a lot of things we can't explain by science, though. And when one says, well, maybe there's evidence here that an intelligent designer is involved in the process, it is common for scientists to do the opposite, or basically the same kind of thing that the Christians of old used to do. But instead of imposing the God of the gaps, they impose the science of the gaps. We don't know the answer, but we'll figure it out sometimes in the future. In both cases, they are making statements that are based on faith that go beyond the evidence, and in both cases, it's a mistake. Ten. I'm just going to give you 10. This will be my last one. The 10th one is... Wait, what happened? Oh, yeah, I didn't write that one down. Okay. God of the gaps. Science of the gaps. The 10th one has to do with the problem of evil. This is a mistake people make all the time. They think that the presence of evil in the world is a good argument against the existence of God, and it turns out to be a good argument for the existence of God. How does the argument of evil against the existence of God work? Something like this. If God were good, he'd want to get rid of the evil in the world. If he were powerful, he'd be able to get rid of the evil in the world. Well, there still is evil in the world, therefore God's either not good or not powerful. Here's the problem. There are two words in that sentence that someone has to make sense of before they can make sense of the objection. If God were what? Good, then there would be no what? Evil in the world. Now here's my question. What the heck is this? And what is that? What is that? What people are doing is they're observing something in the universe that they call evil. They expect that if God had this quality, which they called good, that he would want to deal with this thing called evil. Now, what are those things? It's popular nowadays in discussions about moral things to say that morality is just simply a matter of one's own personal opinion. That there is no morality out there. There is no rules of good and bad out there. They're just things that we make up as we go along. And so my point of view morally is just as good as yours, and so therefore who are you to say what's right and wrong? And who are you to force your morality on me? Now, if that's an accurate way of looking at it, you cannot raise the problem of evil. Because the problem of evil depends on good and evil being objective features of the world. There's got to be evil out there somewhere to complain about. But what is that evil? The only way you can identify evil as something going wrong is if you have a notion of what this is. You have to have a standard of good before you can identify a departure from that standard and call it evil. What is that standard of good? See, what you're going to end up finding out is before you can call something good, you're going to have an external standard of good, and you're going to have some good being like God to define what goodness is before you can identify a departure from goodness to evil. If we encounter bona fide evil in the world, if we encounter bona fide good in the world, there has to be something in the world, and I mean not on earth, but in the existence of things, that presents itself as an objective standard for these things. And that's going to lead you right to God. Consequently, this doesn't turn out to be a good argument against the existence of God. You have to assume the existence of God even to raise the question. Now, I've given you 10 things. I've got a couple more. They're not quite as important as these. But we've got a little more than a half hour left to knock some things around. So I want to open it up for discussion. Questions, rejoinders, rebuttals, clarifications, whatever. Who would like to be first? I'll be nice. I'll be gentle.
Well, when someone wants to know, like...
I guess you want to be first, huh?
I have my hand raised.
Okay.
When someone wants to know why you believe the Bible, why should I believe it? Isn't that a good time to give your testimony? Isn't that, what else would you...
Well, I don't know how my testimony turns out to be a good defense for... Well, it depends what you mean about the Bible. If I'm trying to defend the Bible as the word-for-word inspired word of God, that's a certain kind of task. And that's a big task, by the way, to prove that the Bible is without error. Okay. If what I'm trying to do is show that the picture of the world that is described in the Bible is a true picture of the world, then if I do what the Bible says, it ought to have... a salutary effect on my life. Something changes should be taking place. And then it would be appropriate for me to say, look it, you ought to believe this view of the world because I applied it to my life and look what happened. Now, the problem, there's a liability with that approach, and the liability is that there's a lot of people with experiences contrary to the Christian experience. I mean, you might have somebody who is into transcendental meditation, and they'll say, well, wait a minute, I've got a testimony too. I was in transcendental meditation, which is a form of Hinduism, Vedantic Hinduism of the Shankara tradition, and they said, well, you know, I had these things happen in my life. Well, I don't think it's the case that Christianity can be true and Hinduism be equally true at the same time. In other words, accurate descriptions of the way the world really is. But both people have some kind of experience that they can tell about. I think if any particular point of view is true, it's going to have ramifications in your life. So this is why it's good. I think there's value in a personal testimony, but there are liabilities in a personal testimony too because other people have experiences. This is why I don't think experience is an adequate justification for saying any particular thing is true. What I'd rather do is I'd rather look at the worldview that the scripture portrays and try to give other further evidences why what the Bible tells about the nature of the world, about the nature of man, is worthy of being believed, how it fits the world. Or I might argue from the person of Jesus as an authority figure, as about somebody who had some insight into spiritual things, and say, you know, Jesus ought to be believed because he had tremendous credibility. That would be another way I'd argue. To substantiate the point of view of the scriptures, generally speaking. But I wouldn't engage with a non-Christian in an extended discussion about why I believed every single word in the Bible is true. Because that's just, given where that person is coming from, my point of view isn't going to make any sense. You're going to have to accomplish some other things first. Establish the credibility of Jesus to speak on behalf of God would be a way. You know, why should we trust what Jesus had to say? I mean, that's a fair question. But that's the direction I would go. Yes, sir. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Now it would that might be the case. I don't know in terms of the details. Maybe the rule was that you just had to give a regular prayer and just speak of God. However, if the rule was that, then I think the rule was intolerant because it did not tolerate the particular beliefs of those people that would stand behind the podium and pray. It was actually a rule that required the religious people to be hypocritical. They would have to represent their religious viewpoint as something that it really wasn't. So I would say that that rule would be an intolerant rule. Just as if I were to say, look, this is my class, and everybody has to talk nicely about Jesus. And if you don't, I'm going to throw you out. Well, that would be intolerant because I'm not allowing the expression of another point of view without punishing somebody. In this case, the guy expressed another point of view, and he was publicly punished with censure for what he did. So he might have been out of line for violating that rule. I don't know if there was such a rule. But if there was, then I think that would still qualify as intolerance. Now, your teacher told me that you guys were rough characters. I haven't cowed you all into silence, have I? Yes, Miss Guest Jeans. Yes, two definitions of science, right. Right, right. No, my comments were really at the confusion of the two definitions. Because when they say, we want the scientific evidence to prevail, my question is going to be, what does that mean? Do you mean the conclusions that are properly derived from the evidence of scientific investigation? Or do you mean the conclusions that conform to naturalistic philosophy? All right? And they mean, in that point, the conclusions that conform to their philosophy. Because, I mean, Michael Behe, for example, has shown from his impeccable scientific assessment that there are good scientific reasons to believe that certain biological mechanisms were actually designed by an intelligence, a brilliant intelligence, okay? But that conclusion that follows from the scientific method is disqualified even though it comports with the one definition of science. It's disqualified because it doesn't fit the philosophic definition. And my view is you got to go one way or the other. You can't straddle the fence. You either got to say, look, we're naturalists, and the heck with the facts. We're not concerned about the facts. We're concerned about having conclusions that conform with our philosophy. Or they're going to have to say, look, let's go after the facts and have the courage to follow them where they lead us. That's what doesn't... Now, I think that's changing. But Einstein faced the same problem with the general theory of relativity. When his equations in 1916, from them, he drew the conclusion that the universe started with the Big Bang, what we know now popularly as the Big Bang. He realized, wait a minute, Big Bang, Big Banger. I mean, it was real simple for him. And he actually cheated on his equations for 30 years to try to get away from the idea of a Big Banger. But now in the area of the astronomy and the like, physics, there are very few people who are not theists of some sort now, because the scientific evidence is so powerful. It's irrefutable. Now, this doesn't comport with their philosophy, and they fought against it. But see, this is my point. I'm not really arguing for or against whether evolution or creation should be taught in schools. I'm just simply saying that the whole issue is clouded and confused because these two definitions are conflated. The result is it makes it look like the evolutionary side is playing with facts and the creation side is just playing with a bunch of guesswork that they get out of their Bible. And that's not accurate. It's just not fair, because Michael Behe didn't do that. And Michael Behe isn't just like one voice among billions of scientists who disagree with him. There are thousands of people out there like Michael Behe who are doing very, very good work and coming to the same conclusions. People that do not have a theological axe to grind. Do you hear about them? Almost never. Why? Because they broke the philosophic rule. Some people have even lost their job. Famous professor over at UC San Francisco. What was his name? I can never remember his name when I need to. Dean Kenyon, thank you. In the late 60s, wrote the book on biochemical predestination, Darwinian Evolution of Life from Non-Life. I mean, it was the principal thing. But he started looking carefully at what he taught there, and he just started thinking, he said, you know what, this is not sound. And he drew the conclusion, apart from any theological influence on his life at all, that life was designed. And he suggested it. He just merely suggested it in his classes. He was teaching evolution. I mean, he was the don of the academic field in that particular area, Dean Kenyon. But he said, you know what, I think we ought to consider the possibility that some of these things might be designed. And he was immediately bounced. Made the Wall Street Journal. Immediately bounced. Creates quite a furor. Why was he bounced? Because he was teaching creation and not evolution. Well, the fact is, he was teaching evolution. But he had the temerity to say, to suggest, that the scientific evidence pointed to design. And for that, he lost his job, at least temporarily. He was reinstated in his position. But see, that's what happens. You don't play by their rules, you pay. You don't play, you pay. And that shouldn't be the way it is in science, in a discipline that's supposedly pursuing truth. Yes, in the back? Okay, that's a good question. And to some degree, if I understand your question correctly, I don't understand it either. There are times when Christians, people of different general Christian persuasions, fuss in an acrimonious way about things that are genuinely inconsequential. All right. However, there are things that are genuinely consequential as well. And among the general populace, there's a difference of opinion about this. The general populace has a view that, well, as long as people are basically nice people, why don't you just leave them alone? Why do they have to believe just like you? But see, that doesn't do credit to the claim of Christianity. And the claim of Christianity, which this is one of the claims that is empirically verifiable, is that human beings aren't basically nice people. Human beings have a problem. They can get away with being nice once in a while, but these basically nice people, you know, you catch them in the wrong moment and they'll turn on you viciously, and it happens all the time. And something has to be done about that. There's a moral problem with man on the Christian view of the world. And the moral problem results in true moral guilt. It isn't just that human beings have just slipped up, but they have broken the law of a holy God. And even in this country, you break the law, you pay. So if you've broken the law and you haven't been caught yet, you're a criminal on the run. And if the Christian view of the world is correct, then everybody's a criminal on the run, even though some are lesser criminals than somebody else. So the criminality issue with the law has got to be dealt with. And this was the whole reason that God became a man in Jesus Christ. We just celebrated this Holy Weekend that was all about this this event where God became a man in order to take the punishment or the penalty that all human beings deserve for their violation of God's law upon himself. In a sense, to put it really like, you know, modern terms, we have a bill and Jesus paid it so we wouldn't have to pay it. Now the issue is whether people are willing to put their confidence in that, accept that, opt into it, a lot of different ways to say it. Where they're gonna accept the pardon that God offers, put it that way. If they don't accept the pardon God offers and they think they're okay, they're in big trouble. And all of that to say this, some issues are relatively inconsequential and we fuss about those, but some are absolutely vital. Who is Jesus and was he who he claimed to be, the Messiah? Because if he was, that has to do with everybody. And if you're just playing a religious game in church and haven't really dealt with that, you're still in trouble, even though you're in church on every Sunday. And so that's why, you know, the apostles, Jesus himself, and Christians, characteristically, when they get the picture, they get pretty intense about it because they realize what's at stake. And so the real question is not whether they're intense or not, or maybe to leave me alone. The real question, seems to me, is whether they're right or not, whether Jesus was correct in this claim he made about himself. And if he's not correct, well, forget it. You know, then eat, drink, be merry, and find something else that you like. But if he really was right in what he taught, well, that has ramifications for everybody at every age. And by the way, just as a postscript here, when I say Jesus was really right at what he taught, this is another misconception that Jesus was just this easygoing, loving guy that just accepted everybody. And he thought, well, be peaceful and be kind, and that's what he taught. That's a bunch of malarkey. Anybody who says that has never read the Gospels, which, by the way, are the only source of information of any content that we have about the person of Jesus. If we have an opinion about Jesus, it's got to come from the Gospels or it's not accurate. And these accounts, biographies of Jesus written by those people that were closest to him, show a very holy man who did works of power, but who was very stern on the issue of truth. One might say he was the most intolerant of all people, in that he said, this is what's true, and any deviation from that is false. Now, he was good at seeing through religious hypocrisy and that kind of stuff, but he was very, very stern on moral issues. And, he did say to the woman caught in adultery, they said, if no one condemns you, neither do I condemn you. But then he added to it, go and sin no more, you see. And Jesus was among the most severe on issues of truth. And so this kind of popularized version of Jesus, meek and mild, and everything's cool and everybody's wonderful and I accept everybody, it's just farcical. It's just absolutely farcical. And people believe that at their peril, from my perspective. Which one's Brian? Ah. Yes, ma'am.
Considering what we hear every weekend is from the churches, who do you find the most
Most objectionable or objective in their...
Most objectionable.
Objectionable. Okay, you mean that people that are Christian, or who promote themselves as Christians?
Do you think that religious leaders, do they object to what most of the people, considering, most of the people that come in and ask questions...
I see. You mean on religious shows or on regular... Well... I think that Christianity can be defended if it's properly understood and it's properly articulated. I think there are a lot of Christians who have not been taught well about what the Bible teaches or about how to defend it. And they were given things like, just believe, as if you could conjure up religious conviction by acts of sheer will, which is ridiculous. I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous, you know, as far as I can tell. And so there are preachers who promote this kind of thing. And I have a real trouble with them. There are also Christians who call into talk shows that talk like that. I'm one of the goals that I have with our show and our organization is to help give Christians these kinds of tools that I'm talking about. So when they get on the air and they call in or write a letter to the editor, they can make a credible defense for their faith instead of saying something foolish. And a lot of times they say foolish things, and that's very unfortunate because it takes something that is very credible and makes it look silly. And so then people draw conclusions, wrong conclusions, about the credibility of Christianity. I am deeply troubled by some of those that I see represented on TV, pastor types, that make God into a kind of a cosmic Santa Claus. And the idea is that God is there to serve us rather than we're here to serve him. So he jumps at, we snap our fingers and he does everything we want. This really reflects more of American culture than it does Christianity, biblical Christianity, because American culture is very self-centered and pleasure-oriented. I mean, to become a Christian, you have to admit that you're a sinner. I mean, this is not a popular message. I mean, I was looking at this thing across the wall, and I don't see there anything on that one about I am me, I am okay, about me being a sinner. But you know what? We can read that a billion times, and there's still going to be something down inside of us that's saying, yeah, but you really know that there's something nasty in there, no matter how much you try to convince yourself. And the reason you say that to yourself is because there is something nasty in there. And it comes out every once in a while, even when you try to hide it. And so we need to go to God on our knees rather than going to him, snapping our fingers, expecting him to jump. And so when I see preachers that are communicating that point of view, I'm very troubled by it. I don't think it's biblical either. And I think it does a disservice to Christianity because it just appeals to people in the wrong way. Try him, you'll like him. Jesus will be your buddy. Everything will be wonderful if you become a Christian. That's not the message of the Bible. The message of the Bible is that God is really there and he has a claim on our lives. And we have to play by his rules, not him play by our rules. Did that help there? Okay. Yes.
I'm a sinner.
Yeah. Me too. But I'll tolerate you.
In science, I took biology, and there's a lot of evidence that shows that evolution and the way we evolved and all. And I'm a Christian believer, and I believe in Jesus Christ and all. But you mentioned Michael
Behe.
B-E-H-E. Mm-hmm. Michael Behe, he defends Christianity.
He defends design. Actually, in his book, he critiques evolution in favor of design. He's not really defending Christianity per se in his book. It's not a religious tract.
Okay, you mentioned he has a lot of evidence that shows that Jesus Christ and how we were created.
No, his evidence is that the world is best accounted for by design, or at least certain features of the world are best accounted for by design, which would be an intelligent creator. The issue of Jesus Christ doesn't enter into it. I don't think you can come to conclusions about Jesus Christ by examining the physical world. But you can come to good conclusions about the existence of a designer by examining the physical world, because the designer seems to have left his fingerprints on everything. The issue of Jesus Christ is, I think, resolved in a different method, an historical method. No. Design meaning that some purposeful mind put the world together. It doesn't look like the world happened by accident. It looks like it was built. It's another way of putting it. Built for a purpose. Thumbs are for grasping. They didn't just happen that way. They're for grasping. Mouths are for eating. They were intended to be used for eating. Eyes are for seeing. They just didn't happen to start seeing by accident through some process of natural selection over time. And part of the evidence for that, in spite of what appears to be evidence for gradualism, evolution. There are some other evidence that I think completely knocked that out as a contender, as a contender at least for the whole picture of things. And Behe's observation that some forms, some biological features are irreducibly complex makes that way of seeing everything impossible. See, this is what people don't get. There is evidence, even though you could cite evidence for gradualism, morphology, similarities between bones and stuff, and this seems like evidence for evolution, it's not enough to just do that if you're going to be a rigorous thinker on this issue. You've got to look at all the evidence. It's kind of like you've got a crime that's committed, right? And you say, well, here's a bunch of evidence that points to this person over here. Okay, that evidence taken by itself may seem pretty condemning. But when you add one other piece of evidence, his solid gold alibi, for example. He was actually seen on national TV on Saturday Night News at the very moment this crime was being committed. Well, that's got to trump this other evidence because that's really solid. The same thing with evolution. There are things that point to gradualism, and I can see how people can come to that conclusion. But what has to also be taken into consideration are some of these other features, like the irreducible complexity of life. This is a serious problem, and it's not taken seriously by scientists. And I'll tell you why it's not taken seriously, at least not in public. It's not taken seriously because it doesn't fit the philosophy. I'll give you another example. In order to have evolution, you have to have two things. Minimally, you have to have two things. You have to have a kickoff, okay? And this is what Dean Kenyon was researching. You've got to have what they call abiogenesis. Anybody know what that means? Abiogenesis? Anybody have Latin? Okay, the genesis would be the beginning. Bio is life. Okay, the A is like a negative, like not. So this means life from non-life is what it means. You have to have the genesis of life from non-life. That's the beginning. There's no God. You have inert matter. All of a sudden, somehow, life comes. Okay? I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of it. You got to start life somewhere. Biochemical evolution results in the birth of life somewhere. Then that life changes from one kind to another, according to the story. And we'll use this word to describe that. It must transition from one kind of life to another life. So you have this tree, you have life down here, and then it begins to branch out. And then as you look at the evolutionary tree, you got all of these detail up here from these rudimentary, this one original life that goes into rudimentary forms, etc. And that's the story. That's the way it's explained. This is the way it's supposed to have been. Now here's the question then, is if you don't have abiogenesis, you can't have evolution because you don't have a start. And if you don't have transitions of one kind to another, you don't have evolution because you have nothing changing. You have no evolving. So if someone is going to claim that evolution is true, he's going to have to minimally show these two things. Now here's, let me just deal with the first one. It'll take a little bit of time to deal with the second one. It's a little more involved, but let's just take the first one. How did life come from non-life? Pardon me? Nobody knows. Not only do they not know how it came about, they don't even know how it could have come about. And rather than going forward in the last 20 years, this whole area of research has gone backwards because they have learned more about the nature of life and its complexity, and they're finding out that the problem is much bigger than they ever thought it was. And the more they learn, the more they find that out. Now, here's my question. And it's a very fair question dealing with evolution. If you must have abiogenesis to say that evolution is a fact, and nobody knows how this could ever even have happened, how do they know that it happened? Now, that's a question that goes to the methodology, and the answer is always a philosophic answer. You know what the answer is? We're here. It must have happened. Now, that's called, in your material, circular reasoning, and it's done all the time. This is the only possible explanation. Of course, if you close the world off in a naturalistic system of cause and effect, it's the only possible explanation. And so now you've got the philosophy trumping the methodology. Because the methodology says life is too complex to happen by accident. It must have been designed. It looks designed. And in fact, we all know better. And this is why we always use this term to describe things in the natural world that look designed. What's the term we always use? See it on TV when you watch these animal shows. Mother Nature. Now, why do we use that word? We use that word because the universe, by golly, looks like somebody's behind the curtain messing with things. It looks like it. Now, we weren't going to say, look at this, isn't it amazing? They sometimes will say, the miracle of Mother Nature. Now, what you won't see is they'll say something honest like, it's amazing how over a long period of time, accidents accumulated to produce this amazing thing. Because somebody's going to look at them and say, yeah, right. Give me a break. You know, isn't it interesting that last week they had a big fuss about the Mars face. The face on Mars, right? And it was just the basic outlines of a face. Now, that was later disproved, along with the Mars rock life thing, which you don't read in the front page. The president get up and didn't announce that the Mars rock was a complete, not a hoax, but a complete mistake, but it has been demonstrated to be so. Some people still think there was life on Mars in that. That's been completely disproved by the scientists, by the way, that whole rock thing. They saw this face on Mars. People were just elated because they saw these basic two-dimensional forms on this, very simple, and they concluded from this very simple thing that looked like a face that it must have been made by intelligence. Now, they got a closer picture of it, and it turned out just to be kind of an optical illusion. But isn't it amazing that our natural response when we say just a basic two-dimensional form is that it must have been created by intelligence? You see, footprints on the beach, and no one in his right mind would conclude that something as simple as that would have happened by accident. Oh, isn't it amazing? That looks just like somebody walked here. I know that probably the wind and the rain and the natural forces of nature did it, but boy, isn't it funny how it looks like feet? Somebody's going to look at you and say, are you on drugs? What's your problem? But then you look at something as complex as a living cell, even the simplest living cell. People say, happened by accident. And nobody blushes, which is really amazing to me. How many saw the movie Contact? This was an exceptionally good movie, partly because I like Jodie Foster a lot. I think she's a really good actress. But it was offered as kind of an intelligent discussion about the relationship of science and faith, and I actually think it was kind of banal. I mean, they had an opportunity to do something really brilliant, and they didn't capitalize on it. They did something really silly, I thought. But the movie was still good anyway. But think about this for a minute. Ellie Arroway, right? She's sitting on the balcony with... what's his name? Matthew McConaughey. What was his name? His name was Josh something or other. Or something Josh. He had a weird name in the movie. And she says, why would God exist and never leave any evidence of himself? Which is a fair question. Okay, he did a lousy job of answering it. But what was interesting is as the movie developed, she's listening for SETI. You know, she's with SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and she's listening for these radio things, waiting to get some evidence of intelligent life in outer space. And as you recall, the first evidence of it was this pulsing that she heard that was atypical of the static around it. And the pulses identified prime numbers, 1, 3, 5, 7, 11, something like that. All numbers that cannot be divided, can't be divided by anything but one in themselves. Okay? So now when these prime numbers are coming through, these beats of prime numbers, this is not random. It is non-random. What does she conclude? And, of course, you have that wonderful scene with everybody dashing around and listening and trying to get it on the screen and hear the pulses and get it taped and the whole deal. It's the most exciting part of the movie. But as it proceeds there, you also get something else. You get a TV broadcast of the 1936 Olympics, which is just, you know, the time is just half the amount of time that it would take for the message, or the amount of time for the message to go from the Earth out to the star Vega and then back again. You know, they just bounce the TV image back to the Earth. That was a clever little bit of writing. They said, well, we're getting this thing back. And then inside the image, they do some electronic work, and they find out that inside the image, there's a whole blueprint that's being communicated. Now, what did Ellie Arroway do? What did the whole country do? They made a conclusion. There's intelligent life on Vega. How do they know that? Because of these prime numbers first. And then, of course, because you have this dramatic blueprint that comes through, which ends all doubt. They build the machine. Ellie Arroway commits herself to get into this machine and go to Vega. Now think about it. This is where they could have done some real intelligent stuff on the relationship of faith and science and all that. Ellie Arroway has never, ever seen this Vegan before. The Vegan is an appeal, it appears, is beckoning them, her, someone to come. That's why it sends this blueprint of this machine, encouraging Earthlings to make the machine, get in the machine, and take a trip. A trip which that astronaut probably, as far as they know, will never return from. They don't know if these people are, or these things, the Vegans, I wonder if they called that contraption they built a Vega. I don't know. Well, but they don't know if they're friendly or not. They don't even know for sure that they exist. They've never seen them, but they have evidence in this message. And so what she does is she makes a step of faith. Now, I say a step of faith because what it is, it's a step of trust, which is what faith is. But it is not a blind step of faith. She has information to go by. And based on the information, she believes there's an intelligent something out there. And she is willing to put her whole life on the line to meet this intelligent someone who is beckoning her to come, which is exactly the message of the Bible, in which God is speaking and he is offering, he is beckoning us to come to him, though we hadn't seen him. Now, here's what's clever, though. You say, well, that's different. I said, no, it's not different. Well, yeah, it's different. She had this blueprint right there. And so there was evidence, tangible. It wasn't this faith commitment. Wait a minute. Ellie Arroway sat on that banister, and she said, why doesn't God give me evidence of his existence? She responds to a blueprint that's sent through radio waves and invests her entire life in faith to go to this response, yet inside of her, every single cell in her body was a blueprint much more complex than that spaceship, the DNA blueprint. There was the evidence of God. If she sees the blueprint coming from outer space as evidence of an intelligent designer who made the blueprint, she's got to, by rights, draw the same conclusion based on what she discovers in her own cells. And that's empirical. Same way of testing. See, now, I think that's kind of a neat observation there. That's what they could have played with. Why didn't McConaughey say that? He could have said that. That would have been a good one. But he just said something stupid. Anyway. So you watch that movie again. Get it on video. And you see that. See, because that's the Christian claim. The Christian claim is that there is someone out there. And he hasn't been silent. He's spoken to.